Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, and my next guest is Caroline Hirsch. But you may know her only by her first name, Caroline, which she shares with her comedy club. The iconic spot in Times Square has helped launch the careers of Jerry Seinfeld, Jon Stewart, and Tracy Morgan, just to name a few, and was a key player in the 80s stand-up comedy boom. She's also the co-founder of the New York Comedy Festival, which is celebrating its 15th anniversary this year. The New York Comedy Festival returns to venues around the city November 5th and will run until November 11th. Headliners this year include Bill Burr, Marc Maron, and Conan O'Brien. Caroline Hirsch, welcome to All of It.
Hi, good afternoon.
So 15 years of the Comedy Festival. Do you remember back, what was your first thought about, let's have a comedy festival?
Well, you know, it started when we did the 20th anniversary of Caroline's, and we did this great big show at Carnegie Hall, and, you know, brought back like a lot of the comedians that had worked for us before, like Lewis Black and Dennis Leary, Jon Stewart, and decided that, oh, maybe we should do more of this. And that's really how the festival was created.
What was it about getting all those people together that you thought really worked, that was special?
I think, you know, the audience reaction, and actually, you know, it sold out. And the audience reaction was, you know, we should do more of this. I'd like to come to more of these. And that just kind of propelled me to do it. And it worked out. And
did you start small?
We started smaller than what we are now. I mean, sure. Right now, you know, we're way over 200 comedians.
That's amazing.
And way near almost 200 shows around town. If you add up every single show that we are doing, that's a lot.
And the first year was?
The first year was probably about 12 shows, 15 shows, somewhere around there. And we had lots of shows at Caroline's, so that added to the fun. And this year we have Yvonne Ogie at Caroline's, and we're looking forward to seeing her again at the club.
Who is somebody who just makes you laugh right now in the comedy scene?
You know, Bill Burr does. Marc Maron does. They just hit a nerve. I don't know. It's lots of people make me laugh, though. I have to tell you that I really enjoy my job. Mm-hmm. And I can hear a joke 50 times and still laugh at it. It's like, you know, almost like listening to somebody's greatest hits.
Uh-huh.
I sometimes wait for the comedian to do the joke because I love to hear it, and then I love to see the audience's reaction to it.
How can you tell, you know, you were really great about finding new talent. How can you tell when somebody has that magic thing?
You know, from watching people, I guess, for 35 years, you know when a comic hits on a nerve, mm-hmm. or how they or she interprets it to be a little different than everybody else. And I'm not saying that they're great to begin with, because they really are not. It takes a while to really find your voice. But sometimes early on, you can tell that somebody's got that something special that he or she needs to work on.
It's interesting. Yeah, I think I have some friends who do comedy, and it's really about honing your skill. It's about doing it again and again and again and finding your points and figuring out what works for you, what worked that night, didn't work the other night. It's such an interesting process to watch.
I mean, sometimes it could be the audience too, but it's mm-hmm. interesting that you really need to have stage time, and it takes years to do it, because just by changing a proposition around, it could make the joke work a different way. Just a pause mm-hmm. will make the joke work a different way. Waiting for the audience reaction gives you it keeps you a little more grounded on what comes next.
Yeah.
So it's learning all of that.
We're speaking with Caroline Hirsch about the New York Comedy Festival, which she co-founded 15 years ago. So there's so many different things we can talk about the festival. I'm interested in, I saw the one was the Bechdel cast, a podcast that examines the portrayal of women in film. You know, the Bechdel test is like, are women on screen, right?
And it's women on screen when they don't talk about a man for a certain amount of minutes, or the film is not about men, it's about women, and men are not the focus point of what the women are talking about. That's the Bechdel test.
And so there's a podcast about this, and I'm interested in what you think about how podcasts have changed comedy.
Well, oh, that's interesting. You know, we have a number of podcasts in the festival this mm-hmm. year, but we started out last year believe it was last year. God, it just seems like the years are fading. It's with Love It or Leave It. And they came into town and sold out two shows at the Beacon Theater. And now since have gone on to be on HBO mm-hmm. after that. But the following is terrific for podcasts when people catch on. Bill Burr has a wonderful podcast. It's done a lot. It just, you know, anything that's out there, whether radio, it's another form of radio actually that's going mm-hmm. on. And anything out there where a comedian can get their point of view across just helps them sell tickets in the live event space.
Mm-hmm. And you do have other podcasts that are going to be taking place?
We have a number of them.
Yeah. I think it's interesting because one of the things we talked about just a minute ago was the idea that you have to do it to get better. And podcasts are kind of a place where you can do that.
Well, you know, you would know better because you sit behind a microphone all day and you know what mm-hmm. works on doing it. But I think it takes time for people to understand what comes across. But look, I mean, you know, some of these podcasts are like Joe Rogan's. That's created havoc, and mm-hmm. I mean, they're something special.
There's also this massive event at Madison Square Garden, the Stand Up for Heroes.
Yes, Stand Up for Heroes is our charity event that opens the festival. It's opened the festival for the last 12 years. This is an event that I was very taken aback with the young men and women that went to fight our last war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I saw a documentary about Bob Woodruff. Mm-hmm. And
he was the ABC correspondent.
He's still an ABC correspondent, right. But he was badly wounded. He had a brain injury during the war. He mm-hmm. was in a tank, what they called a stand-up, and they were attacked.
Yeah.
He survived, and afterward there was a documentary on TV about him. And I was watching the documentary, and at the end it said, if you'd like to donate to the charity, and I said, I have an idea of how we can fundraise for the charity, and came up with Stand Up for Heroes. We approached his wife, Lee, in yeah. May, and by November, we had a great event, and we raised $3 million. With this event this year, which has grown to the theater at Madison Square Garden, we will raise close to, you know, near $50 million.
Wow.
That has gone all to the veterans of the war.
And your headliners.
The headliners are...
You'll understand why it's $50 million.
Well, as always, there's the constant, which is Bruce Springsteen. He's back again this year. Eric Church, Seth Meyers, Jon Stewart, Jimmy Carr, and Jim Gaffigan. And surprise guests that drop by.
That's a great show, without the surprise guests.
It's a great show, and it's a great night. And people just... You know, we can't forget, you know, now that war is not always on our mind, there are still men and women that are fighting.
Of course.
And there's a whole lot of people. There are millions of people. A million people have come back, and a million people need to be taken care of.
With profound injuries.
Profound. And it's not only, you know, people are living longer because we can sustain the injuries without limbs, but there's lots of post-traumatic brain stress, mm-hmm. and that's something that we work on.
And that is the Stand Up for Heroes, and that opens the festival. I'm speaking with Caroline Hirsch, the owner and founder of Caroline's, as well as the co-founder of the New York Comedy Festival, which is happening next week. A lot of good stuff happening. You guys are also taking on some of the news of the day. You have a panel with Ron Bennington. He's going to moderate a conversation about some of the best headliners in the country, about some of the controversial issues in comedy, what's too offensive. Why did you decide to just... go for the politics of it?
Well,
and
I think
it
it's interesting. We're doing that with Ron and Sirius Radio, and it's just that it's just something that seems to be on everybody's mind today. Do you go too far? Mm-hmm. What's enough with politics today? Look, we have an abundance of things that we hear on Twitter and mm-hmm. a president that really has made an embarrassment of goods. That people can make fun of at mm-hmm. this point. And that's really part of what's been going on in the comedy scene.
Has there been a lot of conversation among club owners about this idea of what's too offensive? Should I have that comic? I mean, not censoring people, but I'm just interested about, I mean, we have conversations in news divisions about what can we say, what shouldn't mm-hmm. we say?
Well, I mean...
certain words and certain
language,
you know?
There is... You don't want to censor anyone, but you don't want hate on stage. That I will not tolerate. I will not censor anybody, but I will not tolerate hate. So that's the way I put it on that one.
Do you have any new comics coming aboard that people should name? Do you think, you know what, you're going to know this person, this is the next...
Well, we have people that, you know, may not be household words, like Jen Kirkman, mm-hmm. Yamanika Saunders, Kat Cohn, Patty Harrison, Martha Galley. We watch for comics to watch that we do and watch for New York's funniest what we do. These are all people that we have found around the country who we think will emerge mm-hmm. and be the next round of talent coming up.
That's got to be great fun.
It is great fun. New York's Funniest is such a hoot. I mean, it sells out every year, and it's really, really a great event. And lots of people go on after that show to, you know, just be a rising star.
How did you get started in all of this? I mean, when you were a little girl, when we were kids, they weren't like, ladies get to own comedy stores.
Right, right.
It's comedy shops.
When I was a little girl, I watched The Tonight Show. Mm-hmm. And loved comedy and watched the comedians on there. But that's not how I got into it. I was in retail, and I worked for a department store called Gimbel's. And Gimbel's was closing, and I was a market rep. So I went around to all the different, you know, accessory houses and picked out things that might sell around the country. That's what my job was. So when they were closing down, I didn't have a job, and I had two friends that wanted to open a cabaret. They had clubs around the city. They wanted to open a cabaret. And they said, oh, come be a partner with us because you're not working. So we opened as a cabaret, and that wasn't really quite what I wanted to do. So we went out and hired Jay Leno. And that was the start of, you know, turning Caroline's into total comedy. And we never turned back. So it was a great year. You know, we had Sandra Bernhardt that year. We had Billy Crystal. We had Gary Shandling. We had Carol Leifer on her way up. We had Larry David. I mean, we had so many great people that performed there.
What was it about that time in the 80s when it just seemed like every time you turned on the TV, it was another stand-up who got a TV show? What do you think about
that? Well, that happened in the late 80s.
Yeah.
That happened in the late 80s with the start of, you know, Cosby kind of started it, and then Roseanne after that, mm-hmm. and there were, Tim Allen after that. There was this burst of comedy that came out of, I believe, George Carlin from the 60s. Mm-hmm. And I think George Carlin opened the door for a lot of people like Jerry Seinfeld. And Jerry will tell you that he was an influence on him. And what they called observational humor. And it was kind of the start of that, where everybody gets in a room and we all laugh at the same stuff that happened to all of us. I mean, comedy is communal. Mm-hmm. Comedy's about all of us saying, oh God, that happened to me too. Isn't that funny? And laugh. And then everybody else laughs. So it was the start of that. It was the start of David Letterman going on at 12:30 at night and him presenting all of these young comedians at that point that have gone on to become stars, either writers, producers, or starring in their own shows.
One of the things I like about Carol, I've spent much quality time with Caroline's, is that it's intimate. You know, it's got such a big name, but it's really like a nice-sized room. I mean, you can look at the comic in the eyes. I saw Leslie Jones from Saturday Night Live there. She comes off the stage, and she's up in people's faces. And I wonder why you never... Was it intentional to say the size you are?
Well, I think that, you know, it's 300 seats. It doesn't look like it's that large, but it's 300 seats. And it is intimate. It's the way it was designed. It's like this... It's like this circle and the square. Mm-hmm. If you really look at the design, it's a rounded stage that comes to a point, and it's a very intimate space, and it works. So I think, you know, when we designed the space, that's what we wanted, and the architect did a very nice job with it.
Yeah, I mean, and sometimes people have the urge to grow. Like, I mean, you could fill that twice the space. You could fill that every night.
Well, we have a few shows, so that's how we do it. We have two shows a night, three shows a night.
Yeah, sometimes. We're speaking with Caroline Hirsch, the owner of Caroline's. As we mentioned, you know, there weren't ladies who owned comedy stores or owned comedy shops. What kind of challenges did you face when you first started this business as a woman entering comedy, which is a guy's world, guy's club?
You know, I'm asked that a lot. And, you know, when I got out of school, it was like you were never told that you couldn't do something. So I never realized that it was going to be that much of a challenge. I think the challenge was early on finding the talent, then convincing the agents that represented the talent that we were for real and we could pay the comedians. Because that's something new that Caroline's did. We really paid people. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the first week that Jay Leno worked for me. He was paid $2,500 a week. Now, that was a lot of money to pay somebody to perform there for a week. And the agents wanted to make sure that I had the money to pay them. So it was a lot of that, getting that trust from people in the industry, mm-hmm. that we were here and we were honest and we really had, you know, the best intentions for ourselves and for the comedians.
You've watched comedy change. What do you think's been, what have been some of the biggest changes since you opened Caroline's in the genre of comedy?
In the genre? Well, let's just talk about, well, political comedy became, you know, kind of a theme after, you know, the after Bill Clinton, the 92 in there. And then when Jon Stewart and Liz Winstead and Madeline created The Daily Show, mm-hmm. and then Jon Stewart went on to the show. And that kind of really turned the tide for political humor. But I think after Bill Clinton, not that before that for, with Bush, that we didn't, you know, talk about it, but it just became like, you know, a big deal to watch The Daily Show, and that really kind of put it over the top for political humor. But the other part of it is that there are so many more women doing it today, mm-hmm. than ever. I mean, the women are up there. I mean, there are a lot more men doing comedy, but there are many more women doing comedy at this point than when I first started. Mm-hmm. There were a handful of women that worked for me that were able to headline the club at that time.
Why do you think women have been able to make such strides? Was there any sort of watershed moment?
I think that more women were exposed to it after HBO went into producing these stand-up comedy specials.
Oh, interesting.
And then Comedy Central came around and mm-hmm. the Hot Channel came around. They merged years later. But then I had a young assistant that worked for me, and I said, why do you want to be in the comedy business? Well, you know, I watched Jon Stewart growing up and I thought it'd be great to be a writer. I loved, you know, how smart he was. And I thought that could be a career that I wanted to go into. So a lot of young mm-hmm. women were, you know, had watched comedy on cable,
yeah.
and then were introduced to it.
Have you had to deal with any of the Me Too stuff at Caroline's with comics? You know, we've had Louis C.K. showing up at certain places,
yeah.
and in the audiences having a mixed reaction, and yeah. people deciding, oh, the comedy club shouldn't have had them in. Should he be back on stage? Where do you stand on all of this? It's a hard question, but you're a smart lady.
It's hard. You know, I've known Louis since he's 19 years old. Is it time for him to come back on stage? I mean, when will we forgive Louis? So we need to come up with that in our minds about mm-hmm. When are we able to forgive him? I know he has apologized. And I think that we have to clearly think about that when we, you know, people pay their dues. When they apologize, and that he's been through very rough year for what he did as a young man. I'm not saying it was the right thing to do, but I think that when we were younger, we sometimes have made mistakes, and he paid for it, you know, for the whole year, and he's still paying for it now. As far as that going on at my club, I don't, you know what? Most of the comedians work together nicely, respect each other. There's a lot of respect for women at the club, and we protect them. And trust me, people come to me if somebody, even mm-hmm. in my staff, says something that's not the right thing, they are reprimanded by it. As long as somebody speaks out and tells somebody about what had happened.
And it sounds like you have an open door policy about
that. I do. You know, we have a big wait staff, a kitchen staff, and, you know, when people, you know, are working so tightly together, sometimes it's very hectic in a kitchen and people can get out of line, but they're all told to come to me if there's a problem.
A piece of advice you'd give somebody who is thinking, you know what, this is what I want to do with my life. I want to be a comic.
Well, I think that you have to sit down and write a lot of material, try it out on your friends. Then you have to go find these small little clubs and stages where you can get on there and try out your material and go for it. I mean, you have nothing to lose. You have nothing to lose to go for it.
The New York Comedy Festival is running from November 5th through the 11th. Caroline Hirsch is the co-founder of the festival and the owner of Caroline's. Caroline, thanks so much for being with us. It was a pleasure meeting you.
Nice to meet you.
Stay with us here at All of It. Oh, by the way, There are tickets available at newyorkcomedyfest.com. You can catch them online. Coming up next is the quintessential New York question. Where can I get the best pizza? Sometimes you're on the hunt for a pie. Sometimes it's just a slice. After the break, we'll hear from the founder of Serious Eats about the history of the New York slice. Stay with us. You're listening to All of It. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. This may be our most controversial segment since we started this show. Who has the best pizza slice in New York City? You may remember Jon Stewart waxing poetic about all the options back when he was the host of The Daily Show.
Go down to Lombardi's, oldest pizzeria in town, Little Italy, founded in 1905. They make their own pork sausage. You go to Grimaldi's, under the Brooklyn Bridge, a brick oven, but go there early. By 4 o'clock, the line's out to the East River. Totano's. Coney Island, Maron, thin crust with sweet sauce. Arturo's on Houston Street, cold oven, lightly charred crust. Go to John's. Oh, John's. Go to the one on Bleecker if that's full. Go to the John's on the Upper West Side. It's not the same vibe, but the pies. Danino's on Staten Island. They got the breadcrumbs on the bottom. Go Joe's on Carmine Street. Just get a slice. Go to Joe's on Carmine Street.
And while pizza's everywhere in this country, New York pioneered the idea of the pizza by the slice, a form of pizza that is in a category in and of itself. Ed Levine, the founder of the food website Serious Eats, recently published a history of the New York slice, along with a list of 27 New York spots that define New York slice culture. And Ed joins me in the studio. We want to hear from you. Everybody's got an opinion about where to get the best pizza. We do want to hear from you. Our number is 212-433-9692-212-433-WNYC. And have a story. Tell us about your favorite slice shop. Ed, nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
So when did you decide, you wrote a bit about that a lot of the stories about New York pizza are apocryphal.
Yeah.
So why are there so many tall tales?
Well, because pizza lends itself to tall tales, right? It's something that it resonates with everybody. A lot of it goes back to the beginning of the 20th century. So, you have to look at tax records and you have to get really granular. And frankly, that's not the way I do research, even though I wrote a book entirely about pizza in which I ate 1,000 slices of pizza that I published like 10 years ago. I never went that granular. But there's a guy in New York named Scott Wiener who runs pizza tours. And Scott and I have become friends. And Scott's the kind of guy who goes into the tax records. He goes into the deeds. He goes, when we did fact-checking on the piece, and Scott and I did it together with the original managing editor of Serious Eats, Adam Kuban, who's also another pizza freak, he was like, DeFara's opened in 59, not 60. It's like, okay, so... how do we know? Well, I know that a lot of people say that it's 1960, but I've looked it up. And we should really talk to his daughter.
And on the tax rolls, it's about
this.
Yeah,
yeah. Right? And it's like, whoa, it's like, this is crazy.
It's some good, deep research there.
Yeah. I mean, and so that's why it was so much fun to do this story this way with collaborators. When I wrote the State of the Slice for the Times in 2002, it was me eating every slice of pizza in New York. First of all, that's impossible now. As I get older, I find it more difficult to eat 100 slices of pizza in a week. And so to have... collaborators was really, really the way to go. And Scott and Adam know so much. They also, Adam has a great pizza pop-up called Margot's, named after his daughter. These guys really, between the three of us, there was a lot of pizza knowledge and more importantly, a lot of pizza love. Like we love pizza.
Now, I understand the history of the slice starts with the oven.
Yeah.
That is paramount to why we have pizza by the slice. Can you explain why?
Well, because it took Mr. Mastro inventing the gas oven, which enabled people to reheat pizza without burning the bottom. It was really quite simple. And I think, again, this was another one of these things where, like Scott said, talk to his daughter. I think it was either 1934 or 1939. But in any case... Mr. Mastro invented the Mastro pizza oven, and now there are Bari pizza ovens, and there are all kinds of gas ovens. But before that, most of the pizza in New York was, or all of it, was coal oven pizza. Right? Coal was cheap. It was the fuel that many immigrants at the turn of the century used, including Gennaro Lombardi when he opened Lombardi's in 1906. Some people say 1906, but again, here we go. But so, you know, it's that's why the slice was invented then. And it's sort of been through a lot of iterations, right? The New York slice has not stayed consistent in that, what are we talking now, 80 years, you know, 82 years, depending upon when you think Mr. Mastro invented the oven. But so, you know, it's had peaks and valleys, and the classic slice places that we all remember. You know, I'm 66, so I remember a different pizza classic, you know, than you do. Mm-hmm. It all depends on what generation you come from. So, you know, it's, and then we sort of entered the nadir of slice culture, which was the dollar slice.
That was a bad time.
It was a really bad time.
I want to back up though. Where was the first slice sold? Where was the first place to sell pizza by the
slice?
Well,
that's that's a question that we're not really sure of the answer. You know, so some people think that Patsy's up in East Harlem, and they're selling slices actually made in a coal oven, which is really interesting. And they have this little slice window. And then there's L&B Spumoni Gardens in the 30s. But he might have been selling slices by covered wagon before he was selling in an actual storefront. But, you know, and then one of the Nunzio's in Staten Island mm-hmm. is also a place that started selling slices in the 30s. So, you know, it's a really good question.
Not quite sure.
Yeah.
Like you said, there's a lot of legends. All right, go to some calls. We've got some folks
online. I'm shocked.
Chris on line one. Hi, Chris.
How you doing there?
Good. What do you have to say?
Well, first of all, let me just comment. The best pizza comes from a coal-fired brick oven. That's a fact.
Okay.
Basically, no gas ovens. Forget that. But I here's the deal. I spent my first 23 years in Connecticut. I'm from New Haven. But my next 27 years, I've been in New York. So I'm a New Yorker longer than I'm in Connecticut. It's more my home. But the best pizza anywhere is from New Haven and other parts of Connecticut, not New York.
All right, I might have to disconnect
you. New Yorkers will hate me for this, lifelong New Yorkers perhaps, but Sally's, it's legendary. They started out in 1924. They're still there. The owner, the last owner finally died, the wife, but they were bought. But there's another place called Modern State Street, New Haven. I've had John's. I've had Lombardi's. It's just not as good as New Haven. And then there's other places like in Derby and Waterbury that are just about as good. So Connecticut is really the best pizza in our area as far as I am concerned.
Well, I'm glad you're a listener, and I won't give out your phone number, but your pizza's still better.
it's true. You know, when I wrote my pizza book, I talked about the Pizza Belt, which was where the Southern Italians settled by the coast where they could get jobs mm-hmm. around the turn of the 20th century. So the Pizza Belt actually goes from Trenton, where many people think this first pizza place actually opened in what's called the Chambersburg section of the city. And then it goes all the way up to New Haven. And I am intimately acquainted with every slice of pizza you can get in New Haven, including, look, I love Sally's as much as the next person, but the best clam pizza is not even made at Sally's or Pepe's for that matter. The best clam pizza is made at Zuppardi's in West Haven. I don't know if you're familiar, but you should be. They actually shuck the clams to order. It's the last place in New Haven that shucks your clams to order when you order a clam pizza.
Well, I think it's worth it just for that.
Absolutely.
We're talking to Ed Levine, founder of Serious Eats, about the history of the New York slice. And we're going to talk about some of the best spots to get pizza in New York. We're going to get a couple more calls in here. Hi, Scott. Scott's calling from Yonkers.
Hi there, how you doing? I know you mentioned Patsy's before. I think Patsy's, especially for slices, when they're on their game, I think they're the best in the city. I don't think Totono's or Lombardi's compares. And I also want to mention an old pizza place in the Bronx that was in the 70s, which I think is the best pizza I've ever had. It was called Ken Ed's. Ken, uh, K K-E-N-E-D. I was wondering if the guest has ever heard of Ken Ed's, which was around in the 70s.
No, but it's funny. My guess is if we called Scott Wiener, he would tell us about the history of Ken Ed's. We do talk about in the story about Louie and Ernie's, which is in what most people think is the Throgs Neck section of the Bronx, which is also an old pizza by the slice place. You know, we have to make clear, we have to make the distinction between slice places and whole pie places.
Okay.
So Lombardi's and Totono's and even Patsy's, except for the slice window, they're really, you're really talking about whole pies. John's is a whole pie place. Arturo's is a whole pie place. So they're different animals. And not only different animals, but then if you add, like a lot of people gave us a hard time because we didn't include the spicy Spring Street pepperoni slice at Spring Street Pizza. That's because we love that slice, but we were only talking about plain slices. We set our boundaries very clearly when we set out to do this. Otherwise, we would have lost our minds.
Okay. So you picked the 27 pizza spots that define New York slice culture. How did you go about making this list?
You know, it was, first of all, we'd all written lots of stories, done lots of research on our own. Scott goes eats 100 slices of pizza a week on his pizza tours in all five boroughs. And then what we did was we took three separate days where we jumped into Adam Kuban's car and we attacked a different borough each day. Now, I know it only gets to three instead of five, but we covered the Bronx and Staten Island separately, not together. But it was fascinating to do that because we were armed with, you know, lots of reader suggestions and our own experience. And what we found is often the mythology overcomes the reality. So, you know, in the pizza book, Sam Sifton, who's now the food editor of the Times, espoused the pizza cognition theory, which states that the pizza you grow up with becomes the paradigmatic slice of pizza in your mind. So, and I think that's absolutely true. So this place in the Bronx may be awesome, or it may be it's just that the slice our listener has grown up with, and so that makes it the best in his mind.
Right. I'm not going to have you reveal them until the end of the segment, so people keep listening. Let's take a couple more calls. Sebastian is calling us from Queens on line four. Hi, Sebastian.
Hey, hello. I just wanted to use this time to plug my two favorite pizza spots. It's funny you said what you said about the slice you grew up with is the one that you end up thinking is the best, because one of my favorite spots is in Jamaica, Queens, the spot Gabby's Pizza, and it's like a super dense slice with like a really sweet sauce, but it's like one of those things that I've never been able to, it's like a slice I try to find somewhere else and I'm never able to. But my other favorite place is in the Lower East Side of Manhattan called Scar's Pizza. And I think they make like just the most quintessential New York slice. You put a little, they have this hot honey you can pour on top and it's delicious. And on top of that, the space itself is really cool and modern. You can like chill, have a drink, and it's a place I love to go to.
So Scar's is obviously one of the places we put in our 27. Scar is very well known to me and Scott and Adam, and I agree with you. And we mentioned Scar's as one of the new style of pizzerias. You know, Scar was, he was grinding his own wheat for his flour, you know? I mean, that's how crazy this has gotten. But there are these people that are willing to take their knowledge and experience and produce a slice that is better than whatever slice we grew up with, if we would just acknowledge that.
Let's go to Cassius from Bed-Stuy. Hi, Cassius. Line 9?
Hello, can you hear me all right?
I can hear you just great. Hi, Cassius.
Hey. There's Roebling Street Pizza, and it's right off the first exit off Lanesburg Bridge. You know, if you come over into Brooklyn, and it's just like a block and a half away from that exit off the bridge. I hadn't been there for a while. I rediscovered it. It's been there since 1960, and it's just a tiny little, I guess we'd call it cozy, small little place. With it, the way it stands above all the others is that it's just a guy and his wife. There's no one else working there, and they're really nice, down-to-earth, humble people. You can talk to them. There's not blasting music late at night like in all these like artichoke places and all these hipster...
Yeah,
these hipster joints. The hipster joints are just too popular for their own good. They're too loud, and the workers are rude and, you know, obnoxious, and they don't care if you come back or not.
Yeah, it's,
and this is the total opposite. He loves to talk to people, and he's interesting, and it's not a wood or coal oven, but it is a lot better than the standard gas oven.
And actually, you brought up another thing that I've written about, which is the owner-occupied pizzeria theory.
Mm-hmm.
It tends to be true that if the owner is the only person making the pizza, like it was true at Sally's in New Haven for a long time, then you're going to get a different kind of slice and a different kind of experience.
Stanton Street pizza for me. The two guys at Stanton Street. Ugh.
Right, exactly. So that, again, pizza is so resonant. It's such a community-oriented foodstuff. Mm-hmm. You know, it's also meant for sharing, right? It's the greatest thing to get a pizza and share it with your friends or your coworkers or whatever. And it's reasonably priced, even expensive pizza. You know, my friend Anthony Marchieri makes fantastic Neapolitan-style pizzas on the Lower East Side at Una Pizza for $25. But that's the most expensive pizza you'll ever find in your life.
When you call them chefy pizzas.
Yeah, they're chefy pizzas. And by the way, he's not getting rich. He doesn't leave the pizzeria to go home in a chauffeur-driven Lexus.
All right, we've only got a minute left. Can you give me, you can't name all 27 New York spots. Can you give me three?
Sure. So I'll mention one of the ones that your listener mentioned, okay. Scars, which I think is awesome. I think there's a place that I love that just opened called Mama's 2 on 104th and Broadway. And I know I'm being a little Manhattan-centric here, because the third place I was going to mention is the Corner Slice, which is on like 45th and 11th in that weird like Gotham West marketplace. And again, those are all people who are taking the slice to another level. And I think that's a really exciting slice for everyone to try.
Ed Levine, founder of Serious Eats. The name of it is a list of the 27 New York spots that define New York. Slices, a history of the New York slice. You know what? We'll put a link to it on our Twitter page.
Do.
It's a really great read. You were a lot of fun. Ed Levine, thanks for joining us here.
My pleasure.
On All of It. Stay with us. Yeah. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Legendary director and choreographer Twyla Tharp has pushed the boundaries of dance with her groundbreaking work that blends natural movement with ballet and modern dance. At the beginning of her career in 1963, Twyla Tharp has choreographed more than 160 works. She also won a Tony, 2 Emmys, among many other awards. Now, Twyla Tharp brings us the New York premiere of a program focused on her early dances. In Minimalism and Me, Tharp recollects the recreation of her influential early works and the relationship to the minimalist period in visual art. The extraordinary members of the Twyla Tharp dance recreate excerpts from these pieces of work, Tank Dive, The History of Up and Down, concluding with dazzling 8 Jelly Rolls. And Twyla Tharp's in studio, so I'm going to stop talking.
Hey, you did a good job. I think you should keep going. Thank you.
So Minimalism Me is both performance and then there's lecture as well.
I like to call it blah, blah myself. I prefer that to lecture. Yes, I call it an accounting, and it covers the years 65 to 71 with both items from our archive, video, film, photos, excerpts from the dances by the company, and 12 supernumeraries who play the rest of the world, because after all, they were a part of the show in those days. Whether they were audience or whether they were students or whether they were, you know, the real world where dance was engaged.
Why did it seem like a good time now to revisit those works?
Because it's the beginning. As I say, tonight I'm beginning at the beginning. And it's been a while, I think, since audiences have been given access to where it all begins. And I think they feel left out. When you ask them to come in midway through a career or towards, you know, 50 years later, they're going, okay, I'll try. But they don't know where it started. So it becomes, for me, a kind of responsibility to the audience. Say, okay, guys, this is where it began. One long releve in second position for 3.5 minutes to downtown. Why did you do that? And how did you get from there to a whole bunch of people running around in Sheep's Meadow called a flash mob? Why did you do that? And then, you know, what kind of questions were being asked? And I like to believe that an audience says, oh, yeah, those are interesting questions. And then you get to a piece that's a stage piece. Jelly Rolls in 71 was really the first of the proscenium stage pieces. And they say, oh, yeah, I recognize a little of that in there. But if you just start with Jelly Rolls, they go, okay, and kind of blink, blink, where did this come from? But if you give them the way, it's like nuts and bolts, you know. If you want to build a car, you got to know the nuts and bolts. So that's what I think of it as being.
It sounds like context.
It is totally context, and it's the beginner's context. And I've always been interested myself in archaeology. Where's the first chair? Who got the idea in the first place to make a chair? So I go back to, you know, where did I get the idea in the first place to think there was a point in putting bodies in movement in front of a public?
I'll go with the archaeology metaphor. So when you were excavating.
Excavating, girl, that's right, digging down.
What did you realize about your earlier work as you looked back? You said, oh, I was doing X, or I thought I was doing X, but actually I was doing Y.
Actually, I pretty much knew what I was doing from the beginning. But in going back, because I put audience in, I get to look at the audience now more clearly. And also, I get to write out their behavior. So they have a different take, perhaps, than they might have actually. But maybe I've improved somewhat their reckonings, I like to think so, or not, but at least observe that it's the tree falling, right? Does the tree fall if nobody hears it? Who are the listeners? Who are the trees?
We're speaking with Twyla Tharp about her new piece, her new old piece, her postmodern piece, Minimalism and Me.
Postmodernism, not much room for wiggle, as I say, yeah. Minimalism and Me, it was done for the Institute of Contemporary Art in Chicago. They were exhibiting minimalists upstairs, and because I have a number of drawings that haven't been seen that I made in conjunction with the dances, I said, oh, okay, well, let's do this. And they said, well, okay, fine, but why don't you also do some dance, since that's what you really do. I said, oh, okay. So then it was about visuals and movement and in a museum context rather than in a theatrical context. Now it's moved over.
When you were originally creating these pieces of work, how much did the environment you created them in influence the work you
totally
made?
Totally. A piece that's done in a university is going to deal with a certain academic, a more kind of stiffer approach to things than something that's loose and free and running out in the park, like with horses and dogs and the cops are chasing you because you got no permits. And that was useful to a beginner. When I started working, having the parameters of the real world imposed on me gave me something to push against. It wasn't just anything was possible. Not just anything was possible. You had to push pretty hard to see what you could do at all. And that was useful for a beginner.
For those, so in talking about parameters, in terms of norms that you wanted to break, what were some of those norms?
Oh, goody. Okay, here we go. We were all women, right, for the first 6 years anyway, and they were an extraordinary group. In going back to revisit these early pieces, I could have cast all women. It would have been totally appropriate. But to me, the time has changed. And to me, that statement has been made. And to me, it's let's let the guys in the way we would have liked to have been let in the first place. Why keep them out? So The White Whale, which is some video and work I did when I was 7 months pregnant, hello, at Oberlin College, yes. But, you know, I did quite a bit of dancing. Actually, one of our dancers comes to audition for that role. I say, well, Mr. Dibble, that's you? He's going, yes. I'm saying, you're here to audition for The White Whale. He nods his head. I go, you're not a girl. He nods his head, no. I say, you're not 7 months pregnant. And he nods his head, and I say, oh, well, and a pillow flies in, and he starts stuffing under his shirt. I say, as I'm an equal opportunity employer, let's see what you can do. And it's very touching to see a man think about being protective of a seven-month pregnancy, and how carefully he moves that pillow around. It's very touching, actually. But rather than insisting on finding a lady who's 7 months pregnant who is willing to get up there, I thought, let's let a guy do it.
That's pretty great.
Yeah. So I think that women have reached that point where it's about sharing what that experience is, what it means, and gaining the respect on both sides mm-hmm. for doing that.
We're speaking with Twyla Tharp. Her new piece is Minimalism and Me. Its New York premiere will be November 14th at the Joyce Theater. It'll play there until December 9th. I have to ask about something that I read in my research, and I just want to, just because it's on the internet doesn't mean it's true.
Go for it.
That you, early in your career, to find spaces to perform in, you looked at condemned buildings?
Yeah, we got the city's listing of condemned buildings, and that's where we went for rehearsal spaces, because we had no money, and to get a big area, like a gymnasium or an area that was big enough, some of those pieces were very large, we would, you know, take the ferry over to Staten Island for 5 cents and get into a condemned school that had no flooring, and some of them obviously were quite dangerous, but that was the space we could find, and we used it, and there you have it.
What other spaces do you like to see your work performed in?
I'll go for anything. Anybody who is prepared to survive the onslaught will take it on. So, you know, that's, for example, films. When I made Hair, when I worked on Hair with Foreman, we did dances on concrete staircases. I'd already done that at the Met. We did dances in the park. I'd already done that in another piece. The commercial world just opens out opportunities that if you're adventuresome, you've already had.
There's something really moving about seeing dance out in the open, not uh-huh. in a studio. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's because it seems endless around the dancers. Do you think about that when you create a piece about what the environment is going to be like?
Totally. I mean, if I'm doing a piece that I think of as being contained by the architecture, it's guided by the structure of it. Mm-hmm. If one is in the fields, I mean, I worked on a farm. In fact, one of the pieces that's in here is The Fugue, which was made in fields out 4 hours north of here. And some of A. Jelly Roll's even was done on that farm. And the openness of the space has a large impact. But it's also, as I say, in place, in relation to some of these excerpts that were done for exterior spaces or for shopping malls or where people circulate in a certain kind of pattern, it's all influenced by those parameters. I'm a farm girl. I'm from the Midwest, and I grew up on huge open spaces, and I'm comfortable there. And otherwise, it's claustrophobic.
So you're a farm girl. You grew up on a farm.
Yep.
How'd you wind up being a dancer?
My mother, it always comes back to your mother. You know that.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. But in what way?
My mother decided when I was about 8 years old that the family should no longer be in Indiana, having been there for about 5 generations. And so she would move us to Southern California, where she would start a drive-in theater in Orange Groves, and we would all grow up closer to Hollywood, where there could be a future for us. That was her thinking.
Well, she thought big.
She did.
That's sort of an American story, though, right?
Totally.
Leave the Midwest, head to California, anything's possible.
Totally. And she was phenomenal from that point of view. I always say I was not a feminist. She was a feminist. She fought that battle. I assumed that we did what we thought was important. End of story.
When did you know that you were going to do this professionally, that this was going to work? That I am a dancer, I am a choreographer, this is my life, this is who I am. period, full stop?
Okay, those are different questions. When I knew I was a dancer is, I thought, when I graduated from college. When I started making dances was when nobody would hire me as a dancer. I could be quite difficult. When I felt I'd become a choreographer was about 10 years after my first concert, when I felt as though I knew enough to take on that title.
As you can see, it would be an excellent evening to spend hearing Twyla Tharp talk about her work. Minimalism and Me premieres at the Joyce Theater on November 14th and runs through December 9th. Twyla Tharp, thank you so much for being with us on All of It.
Thank you, sweetie. Thank you very, very much. Thank you.
And that is our show. Thanks for listening to All of It. Join us tomorrow at noon on WNYC. All of It is produced by Megan Ryan, Rosie Guerin, Catherine Millscop, Andres O'Hara, Joseph Capriglione, and Ursula Summer. Matt Miranda is our engineer, and Luscious Jackson does our theme music. You can follow All of It on Instagram and Twitter at All of It WNYC. Thanks for listening.